This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. About 2,000 people gathered in Pittsburgh recently for gas and petrochemical industry conferences. Despite those numbers, investors from China were not on hand to talk about their $80 billion investment in West Virginia. Nancy Andrews reports the reason Chinese business people weren't there was because of recently imposed tariffs.
At both the Northeast Petrochemical Construction and the Hart Energy Doug East conferences, international trade was highlighted as a topic of discussion. For petrochemical producers, notably the businesses that take natural gas and crack it into ethylene that ultimately shows up in plastics, tariffs are becoming a concern.
We're going to have an oversupply. The relief valve for that is exports.
Taylor Robinson is the president of PLG Consulting. He spoke to the industry stakeholders about increased production in the region, including details about how new plants in the area are coming online.
I'd say one of the biggest risks right now is tariffs. China has put a big tariff on imported polyethylene. So that has thrown a big wrench into lots of the Gulf Coast producers' plans to export to China, the largest market in the world for polyethylene. So never a dull moment.
And on the production side, U.S. steel tariffs were giving one Canadian pipeline firm pause. Cale Johnson traveled from Calgary with Canadian Core Line Pipe to work the floor. For him, tariffs were already having an impact.
Big time, yeah. So our product is steel. So we have been directly affected by the new tariffs. So that has it's increased our commodity price significantly. So it's been challenging. However, all steel products are affected. So it's just a challenge that the whole industry is faced with.
Johnson says ultimately, end users will have to pick up the increased costs created by tariffs.
For our product, because we are from Canada, we get Canadian steel, so we have to weigh opportunities, and we might have to, if we are launching down here, evaluate American distribution or pipe that's made in the States to kind of avoid those tariffs.
At Hart Energy's Doug East, which brings together natural gas industry drillers, shippers, and support businesses, much of the focus was on how to better adjust to the current market. Gas prices are low and production increasing. So the question is, how do you drill smarter? Benjamin Hulbert and his company Eclipse Resources has recently set records for the length of laterals. That's the horizontal distance from the vertical drill in the well pad. They've drilled out more than 20,000 feet. That's nearly 4 miles from the well pad.
One of the things, obviously, that we've tried to focus on as a company is to constantly be an innovator. I think the truth is, in today's natural gas environment, if you're not the low-cost producer and the low-cost driller, you're going to struggle to survive.
Lots of conference attendees were optimistic about the future of the industry, despite the absence of the Chinese investors and businesses. Sean Quinton works for a German company, Lind Engineering. He came in from Oklahoma. Their engineering firm designs and builds the plants that are essentially the giant refrigerators that cool the natural gas so that it separates into the different gas types, methane, ethane, and so on. Currently, they've got one job in the region, and he thinks they'll get more.
It looks like there are really good numbers out here, a lot of variety in the attendees. And so everybody from kind of your end users all the way down to your suppliers. We've had some really good traffic. Unfortunately, I'm just about out of cards. And so I really am. We only have a handful left. And so I mean, I brought 100. And so last time we were here, we didn't give away that many at all. And so tickle pink to have that problem.
Along with workforce issues, trade wars, and low gas prices that can affect growth, other issues surfaced. Community concerns and protests against drilling and pipeline construction are now part of the industry's equation. There was some limited discussion on environmental issues, such as leaking methane gas from wells and pipeline. That's a big deal when taking into account the entire life cycle of natural gas and its impact on climate. One speaker cited climate change with a different twist. The extreme weather events that hit the Gulf Coast production areas, the flooding there regularly takes out petrochemical operations. So in comparison, our region's weather is relatively tame. Thus, some argue, could be a more reliable home for more days of petrochemical production. Reporting from Pittsburgh, this is Nancy Andrews for West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Ohio Valley includes two of the country's top three states for auto manufacturing, and the industry employs more than 1.5 million people in Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia. That industry is growing nervous about the Trump administration's trade policy. First came tariffs on steel and aluminum. Now, as Becca Schimmel reports, the Commerce Department is looking into taxes on imported autos and parts.
Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross testified before the Senate Finance Committee last month to defend the administration's trade actions and lay out what might be next. He said he's investigating whether imports of autos and auto parts threaten national security.
This administration is standing up for American families, American businesses, and American workers by taking action to reduce imports that threaten our national security.
Senators questioned Secretary Ross about a possible trade war, retaliatory tariffs, and Trump's threat to impose a 20% tariff on imported cars. Republican Senator Rob Portman of Ohio was among several lawmakers growing nervous about the Trump approach to trade policy. Portman said the national security rationale for tariffs should be used with caution.
Frankly, my concern is the way we're using it now, it's both misusing it and having negative economic impacts in certain sectors.
Portman State and neighboring parts of the Ohio Valley have a lot riding on auto trade. Last year, the region imported more than $13 billion worth of automobiles and automotive parts. Some industry leaders say today's auto industry depends on a global supply chain, and many auto manufacturers in the Ohio Valley depend on foreign markets and material, making them highly sensitive to import taxes. For example, Toyota says the price of a Camry would increase by at least $1,800.
The most American car, the car with the highest amount of American content built in America, is a Toyota Camry in Georgetown, Kentucky.
That's Dave Tapman, executive director for the Kentucky Automotive Industry Association.
The reality is that the Camry still has 30% foreign content.
Tadman says the Camry is a prime example of how today's auto industry's complex supply chain works and how parts move across the border. That means taxes could make cars a lot more expensive.
The design, build, and manufacture of a car today is a global enterprise. There's no way to change the supply chain such that it would only be built in one country.
The International Trade Administration says if a part crosses the border multiple times in different stages of production and is determined to be of foreign origin, it could be subject to a tariff at every stage.
So, for instance, the parts that I speak of that cross the border 6 and 7 times, they're going to get tariffs every time? I mean, think about the implications of that. So now, suddenly, let's say it's a 20% tariff. All of a sudden, you just talked about a 140% tariff on the same part.
Tapman says the potential for tariffs is already causing uncertainty in the market, and manufacturers are holding off on capital projects or additional job investment. The Peterson Institute for International Economics, a private nonprofit think tank, estimates the cost of an average vehicle could go up by $1,500 to $7,000, and the U.S. could lose 195,000 jobs if tariffs are applied on all countries for automobiles and parts. Toyota employs 137,000 of those people. The company emailed a statement saying, "The only plausible outcome of this investigation is to reject the notion that automotive imports threaten national security." Dave Tapman shares those concerns.
And I think this is perhaps well-intentioned effort. We're concerned that it's actually going to cause a loss of American jobs.
The Commerce Department has until February to make a recommendation, but a report is expected to come before the midterm elections. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Becca Schimmel in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Almost 75 years ago, a soldier from West Virginia became one of thousands from America who died trying to liberate the Netherlands from the Nazis. A Dutchman has been tending the soldier's grave and trying to find out more about him since he was 13. The story caught the ear of a documentarian who made a film about it. West Virginia Public Broadcasting is airing that film tonight. Today, we'll listen to a story Jesse Wright filed in 2015 about the making of that film.
Martin Vossen remembers his grandmother telling him stories as a child about what it was like to live in the Netherlands under Nazi rule. But he also learned from other family members about the bars of chocolate and the smiles the Americans brought with them when they liberated the country in 1944. Vossen's grandmother died when he was 8, but her stories grew into a fascination about the war.
Then I heard that you could adopt a grave at the American Military Cemetery in Marquardt.
In 2002, when Vossen was 13 years old, he did adopt one of the 8,300 graves in the cemetery to look after. In fact, all of the graves in the cemetery have been adopted.
When I saw that name on that cross, on the white marble cross, James Wickline, I knew he was someone, you know, who sacrificed his life for my freedom, for the freedom of the Netherlands.
Vossen began researching the soldier buried under the cross. He got Wickline's personnel file from the U.S. Total Army Personnel Command in 2003.
It contained a lot of information, like personal letters from his mother, expressing her anxiety to American authorities and asking for more information, any information there would be about her only son, which was, kind of emotional, and that was also something that really kept me going on this search.
Vossen found out that Private First Class James Wickline grew up as an only child in a small mining community outside Morgantown called Scott's Run. Wickline enlisted in the Army after high school, eventually joining the 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment. Wickline was one of the first casualties of an ambitious attempt to invade Nazi-occupied Holland called Operation Market Garden. Wickline's parachute failed to open when he jumped out of a Douglas C-47 transport plane on September 17, 1944. He was just 21 years old. The goal of the operation was to drop in behind German lines to secure a bridgehead across the River Rhine so ground troops could invade Germany.
We're going to fly 35,000 men 300 miles and drop them behind enemy lines. It'll be the largest airborne operation ever mounted. This kind of thing's never been attempted before.
The operation was documented in the 1977 movie A Bridge Too Far. The initial mission failed, but it did eventually lead to the liberation of the Netherlands and became a jumping-off point for the Allied invasion of Germany. But getting Wickline's personnel file left Vossen wanting to know more. What did he look like? Where did he go to school? What was life like for him growing up? So Vossen visited West Virginia in 2012. He rented a car and drove around Morgantown in the Elkins area, where Wickline's family moved after the war. He chased down a few leads, but
unfortunately, I left with as many questions as I came with.
Vossen didn't give up. When he got home to the Netherlands, he contacted the Intermountain newspaper in Elkins. A reporter there wrote an article about the search and eventually got Vossen his first picture of Wickline. Vossen made another trip to West Virginia last year. This time he was able to speak with one of the neighbors of Wickline's parents and found out that Wickline went to University High School in Morgantown. The school has since moved across town, but with help from school officials, Vossen found a copy of Wickline's yearbook and other documents. Vossen says that as he found out more about Wickline, he felt a deepening connection to the young soldier. He wanted to give Wickline a life beyond a name on a cemetery cross.
It's kind of that you want to change, you know, the history. You want to change his life. You want to give him the life, you know, that he just got back after the Second World War, got married, got children, you know, things like that. I wanted to create that. I wanted to make the impossible possible because it's just so sad that he has never really experienced that.
Vossen's desire to record Wickline's story is becoming a reality. Documentary filmmaker Marijn Poels heard about Vossen's story through a member of the Dutch Parliament. Poels was skeptical at first because he had never been interested in stories about war, but decided to give Vossen a call anyway.
I think the first minute it hits home. It's a connection, a friendship between two people from a completely different time.
He says he was struck by the emotional bond Vossen has with Wickline.
When I'm talking to Martin, he's talking about, you know, like a father figure, about James, you know, trying to extend the life what James never experienced. I fell in love with this story.
Poels decided to make a film about Vossen and his quest to find out more about Wickline, called Ageless Friends. But beyond the bond between the two men, Poels says the story is a way to talk about war in a larger context.
Finally, we've got a sort of ambassador to translate the story of Second World War, all these veterans, what is war about, what is freedom, what is democracy. We found a very good ambassador to bring that story on you know, a younger generation, because I think the world needs an understanding of freedom and democracy.
Poels traveled to West Virginia with Vossen in early July of this year to retrace his steps. They stayed with Monongalia County Commissioner Tom Bloom. Bloom has helped Vossen in his search since 2012. He says Vossen's desire to tell Wickline's story struck a chord with the Morgantown community.
What Martin has done through his determination and his headstrong stubbornness, which I think is great, has gotten people to realize we can't never forget.
Bloom headed up a successful legislative effort to rename a bridge in Scott's Run for James Wickline. The naming ceremony was held in July, so Vossen got to witness the creation of a permanent monument to Wickline. It's a reflection of the bridge Vossen has built between the past and the present, and between one nation that feels indebted to another for its liberation. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jesse Wright in Morgantown.
You can watch the film about Martin Vossen tonight at 9 on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.